Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm honored to have as my guest Michael Ondaatje, whose most recent novel is Divisadero. It's published by Knopf. Of course, Michael Ondaatje is the author of The English Patient and Anil's Ghost, In the Skin of a Lion, Running in the Family, his memoir, Coming Through Slaughter, as well as books of poetry, most recently Handwriting and The Cinnamon Peeler, a book of interviews with the superb film editor Walter Murch called The Conversations, Walter Murch and the Art of Editing Film. Now, I'm interested particularly in the shape of Divisadero because it tells, in a sense, two stories. And I wondered how that shape emerged or evolved in the course of the writing.
Well, it began with the landscape of Petaluma and in Northern California, and then specifically a farm in that landscape, and it was peopled originally by a woman or a young woman, and there's the scene with the horse that attacks her was really the first scene I wrote, but later on, gradually, when I went back to it, there were two girls. There was not just Claire, but Claire and Anna. So I had this kind of seemingly nuclear family on this farm. You know, the father, the two girls, and the hired hand, a young teenager called Coop. And so that, but the only ones who are really related in reality are the father and the young girl Anna. And that was the landscape of my book. I thought I had no idea where the book was going to go, but this has happened before. I had to begin somewhere, and it was the landscape of that farm with that family bound together, even though they were not a blood family. And after the kind of traumatic incident of the fight with the father and Coop and Anna, I had imagined that would splinter the family and they would each go off in three different directions. And I think at first when I wrote it, I had a sense that Anna's life did not come into it at all, strangely. In some ways, she's the most important person. But I sort of had her hovering around, silent. It was almost like the whole book was her book. That was my original thought. And I knew that she had become an academic or writer herself, and that partly because of the romance languages that she was involved with through her mother, she would get interested in the past because her own past had been shattered. And so she would go towards France and research a writer in the past, a French writer. And that's as far as I thought it would go. You know, I thought one of the lives that would be portrayed would be Coop as a gambler, Claire as a public defender's researcher, and Anna in this other world of, you know, archival works and researching a French writer. And I think that was the original plan, but all my books have kind of had original plans which then kind of get enlarged, you know. And Running the Family, it was a sort of a social swirl of, you know, rather irresponsible people in Sri Lanka. And then suddenly I kind of realized I had to take another step and write about my father's alcoholism and his loneliness in more detail and without all the light comedy involved. And so most of my books have kind of, you know, gone towards the middle, knowing that perhaps something is going to happen that will kind of divert me, you know, the way Anil's Ghost stays in Sri Lanka as opposed to goes off with Anna, with Anil when she goes back to North America. And then gradually, I just started thinking of this French writer that she was writing about and researching. And about halfway through the book, I just began to write these sequences in France. And I wasn't quite sure about if this was a good idea or whether this was something else. But I knew it was the same. I knew it was the same book. I felt it was very, it was the next step again for this story. And I just went with that story. And then, so that was really the first long draft I did. And then I had to go back and somehow kind of reshape the book in ways that would kind of make it more, understandable, but in a way, I didn't realize all these connections were there until I went back to look at it.
Yes, I found the book haunting, mm-hmm. and there's a whole sense of the sense world, the ghost world, the observed detail representing more than the arcs of narrative themselves.
Yeah.
And they get linked, as they did in The Skin of a Lion, by repetition. There it was often sparks and bits of light that would join scenes together. And I wondered, once you start enforcing those connections, stapling them in the course of writing, how are you still in charge of what the book comes to mean?
Well, I think if I was aware of all those things when I was actually writing, I think it would be a problem. It's like knowing the punchline of a joke before you get to it. I think there's a kind of intimacy in trusting that unconscious world to appear and reappear and rhyme and echo throughout the book. I'm not planning this. When I sit down to write, I'm not going to feel secure that this will happen. I'm never very, very secure about the book until quite late in the day and maybe after the book has come out, really. But I think when I go back and rework it and rewrite it numerous times, it is a case of trying to kind of decide whether this is too obvious a connection or if it's... or should that connection be there? Has it been said too many times? It's like discovering a sonnet which refers to birds all the way through, and the author did not know it had all this bird imagery.
Yes, but exactly. It does seem to me that in reading your books as one goes along, there's a more and more of a chiaroscuro effect, mm-hmm. that certain elements of plot are placed into the landscape so that where the stories meet will be represented by a road that meets a river.
Right.
And if we don't respond, if we don't know how to roll with the book's mixture of event and landscape, that the book really is designed to be a sensorium, mm-hmm. and that you are meant to respond to minute changes of mood and gesture that the book allows you to say, my Anna doesn't have a mother. Let me bring in a Raphael who does have a mother. And now let me contrast Raphael with the mother of my writer, who has an interesting mother as well. And these characters don't become foils for one another in a Shakespearean sense, mm-hmm. but rather the nimbuses, comparisons between their backgrounds. The book seems to get shaped by an understanding, say, of what it means to have a mother, or in this book, what it means to enter a story. At one point, a character is aware, as frequently in your work, Three Musketeers-like writing is childhood reading, that when you enter a story, you're acquiring a past. It's not your past, mm-hmm. but what you remember of a story becomes your past. Mm-hmm. And in the case of one writer in the book, it becomes his future, too. He ends his life as he began it. He read stories of derring do, and now, under a pseudonym, he writes 7 books mm-hmm. in which revenge and romance, retaliation, becomes the essence of the life he lives while he writes.
Yeah. I'm not quite sure how to answer that question, but I agree with you. I think that's, you know, in many ways, the kind of, what you were talking about, when you talk about the various mothers or the various fathers in the book, you know, I mean, that kind of, those parallels. It's going back to something I kind of sort of became very conscious of when I was writing In the Skin of a Lion, which is the mural, the Diego Rivera mural, where you have somebody's gesture with a pencil on this side of the wall and somebody's gesture with a wrench on the other side of the wall, and the hand shape and positioning is almost exactly the same. And so suddenly, you know, silently you have this link between those two things. And again, I didn't step into the book thinking I was going to write about fathers and mothers, but you know, it's so much about parents and children, or children and parents, and they get reversed, or in one story the child runs away, in another story the father runs away, you know. And again, if I had planned this, I think it would have been more labored, you know, or seemingly more labored for me to write it. But it was something that evolved in the kind of discovering of the story, I guess.
And yet, these things seem, once they are seen, to be made conscious. For instance, you were mentioning that a horse stamps on a girl. In the final version, there are two girls who are attacked by the horse. The man who comes to rescue them mistakes one for the other, calling Claire by Anna's name. Later, the other sister will be sleeping with the rescuer, and it's said that they've exchanged hearts mm-hmm. in the course of their connection. Now, these are not the events of chronological plot, but we do get a sense then that the way this book is going to work is by cross-identifications mm-hmm. and a kind of mystery of feeling that, in a sense, although we may never hear of Claire again, or Claire never hear of Anna, that somehow or other there is the possibility of knowing intuitively what another person's destiny is like.
Yes. I mean, I think it's what we were saying earlier on about what's outside the frame, what's outside the frame of the story. And I suppose one of the problems some people have with it is that it feels unfinished, that they want a conclusion, you know, for some of these stories. And I always imagine arcs outside the book, you know, a leap from in the last 30 pages to a year later. I mean, all the possibilities remain there. It's almost as if I don't really think the novel can encompass a whole life or the lives of these four people or five people or six people, you know, not even one person. So it's almost like a rule that the book has to be unfinished. That, you know, the plot of the novel or the situation of the novel is not fully spoken. And so in that sense, even going back to earlier books, I've always felt that.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Michael Ondaatje, the author most recently of De Visadero, published by Knopf. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Michael Ondaatje about his new novel, De Visadero. Now, to clarify that reference to outside the frame, I mentioned to you that it struck me that your last book, which was a book of several days of conversation with the film editor Walter Murch, had had a big effect on this one. And I say that in particular because Murch, as a sound editor, he worked on The Conversation and on the Godfather films, and indeed was the editor and deviser of the soundscape for The English Patient. Murch is very conscious of what is happening outside the frame of what's being seen. And in some cases, he puts it there by adding sounds. I mean, one is astonished by him in general, but astonished, for instance, when he says, oh, I added that church bell. It's meant to be at least a mile in the distance. The reason it's there is that up until this point, all of the sounds we've heard that are made by people are the sounds of war, martial sounds. This is a sound of human civilization, and it's the first in the film. And you say, oh, my, and I barely registered it.
Well, it works on that subconscious level. You know, art does work on that subconscious level.
Ideally. But I thought I'd ask you to illustrate what I call the Murch effect with a report from the book, The Visadero, of its writer character on a battlefield. He's in a tent, and we're being told about what is outside the frame and even outside the visual frame.
The solitude at Epernay gradually released him from the everyday world. He witnessed only what he saw through the open flaps of his tent. Once he overheard a strange rustling that confused him as to what was occurring outside, until an officer was revealed attempting to fold up a large topographical chart. Sound, and thereby imagined plots of sound unwitnessed by the eye, became important. He was lying on a daybed at Marseillon, listening to the gradual approach of crows and then their bickering in the poplars. He remembered the familiar hoofbeats of Marie Nature's cart horse, the rustle of the outdoor shower as it sprayed onto the earth, muted now and then by a body that stepped into it. He could make out the sound of scalpels in the medical tent being placed back onto rubber sheeting. There was a dying man's cough three tents over, and in it the hidden fear that Lucien could recognize. He had these maps of sound, and they taught him to locate distances, to distinguish a footstep on mud as opposed to dust, or whether a voice was moving towards him or away.
Michael Ondaatje, reading from The Visadero. Now, that seems profound to me, because if we were to say that this tent, through whose flap the character can only see so much, what if that is consciousness? It seems to me that in the writing of an Ondaatje novel, what is seen is what consciousness can allow itself to see, and that other things are put outside the frame. A character in this book says about reading that he doesn't need to know crucial things, that you're more involved when crucial things are left out.
Mm-hmm.
He's saying this, in fact, after he's lost an eye and can't read himself and has to be read to. And I think that the reader of Ondaatje has to develop something of a taste for not being told everything you need, of following consciousness as it follows a path of what attracts its attention.
Mm-hmm.
That there's, you know, a bird is going to go and the eye is going to go with it, and before long, the descriptive process is going to tell us something about birds.
This is a very big question and discussion in the sense that I think that what you see outside the tent is the conscious, what you are able to see outside the tent, and then what you don't see, what you imagine around it, is the unconscious in a way. And also that the fact that the consciousness itself changes, you know, that it evolves and it, you know, it changes by sentence, and, you know, that you might be standing on the, Raphael might be standing in a room, but he can imagine the world from the point of view of a bird and looking down. And in looking back on the book now, I think much of the book is almost seen from up there. You know, the events that, you know, there's a retort of a gun and some smoke from a gun, that the random small sounds of a cart horse or something like that. And that's been the kind of main image of the book for me now. And when I wrote it, it felt like I was sketching. You know, I wasn't painting a camera. And my books usually take a long time to write. I mean, this one also took a long time to write. But I kind of, when I was writing this book, it felt like I was writing faster and going to scene after scene, which I wasn't quite prepared for. And they were like sketches. And that image and then the idea of being that bird in high above human life, kind of witnessing it from and moving at quite a speed from landscape to landscape. Those are the two things I sort of, how I think about the book now in some odd way.
I noticed that when you were talking about your favorite novels, several of them are philosophical novels. The Calvino, The Baron and the Trees, and The Blue Flowers. They're about ways of seeing the world. And I began to think, these books in their, your books, in their ways of thinking about vision, are philosophical novels as well. They're not formal. They're like poems about philosophy and vision, but they are almost literally about seeing, being punished or blinded for seeing, about having lights get too bright and occluding vision, that the world of the seen joins to the world of the mind and the spirit and instructs your characters.
There's something about the kind of almost casualness, I think, too, of when that happens, you know, that we kind of we can drift off here. And there's some line about Raphael's father about he could be persuaded by, I can't remember the line, is some line about, you know, he could be kind of made wayward by a leaf or a breeze or something like that. And I think this is one of the odd things for me when I read a review or a report on a book, or actually any book, not just mine, is where that the review or the article is so final about how someone feels, how Anna feels about this, or how Raphael feels about that. Because I think, you know, everyone is changing so fast. I mean, you know, within the next paragraph, they feel differently. It's the most disturbing thing to me when I read an account of a book, because, you know, no, this isn't Anna. There are a flock of Annas. There are hundreds of Annas. You know, Anna has gone through a time where, you know, that whatever that moment is, that is splitted her into numerous Annas, you know.
Well, I'd say it's a very mysterious way of writing, Michael. There's no guiding force here that's going to restrict us to one point of view. It's not really what you often say, cubism, because it's not about the design either. It's not. It seems to be about how the world generates and groups all the things that can be thought about it. So that living in the world and being in a war requires, now that you hate the war, then that you save a soldier, then that you save yourself. And all these contradictory impulses are side by side and must be represented by a novelist who believes in the poetry of the novel rather than the action of the novel.
Yes, I have to admit I believe in the poetry of the novel rather than the action of the novel. And I mean, I don't think I realize how much poetry has influenced the novel. I mean, I say it does and for various times, but I think in some ways the dependent structure of this book is poetry. You know, it is the villanelle in some ways, you know, which is kind of wonderful, ridiculously strict form in some way, but it's like recurring, going back to the same very obvious rhyme, you know.
It's an amazing structure of writing. You know, destined always to dissatisfy literalists,
yes.
But to haunt those people who don't want to be told things but want to hear the re-echoed echo. Mm-hmm. I wondered if you would mind reading the book's final sentence, because it does seem to me to be exactly that. Well, let's take the last paragraph.
Okay.
Michael and Dasha reading the end of Divisadero.
Lucien pushes the boat free of the mud shelf and strides beside it through the cloudy water and climbs in. He turns his back to the far shore and rows towards it. He can in this way travel away from, yet still see his house. Water laps up between the boards, and he feels he is riding a floating skeleton. He is able to distinguish the shape of his small home in the quickening dusk. He wants to stand, to see everything clearly, and at the very moment of his thinking this, a board breaks below him like the one crucial bone in the body that holds sanity, that protects the world, that protects the road out to the future. His gaze holds on to this last, porous light. Some birds in the almost dark are flying as close to their reflections as possible.
If you wanted the fortune cookie description of this book, some birds in the almost dark are flying as close to their reflection as possible, would do a very good...
What's very strange is, but I wrote that, I had no idea that was the ending. I thought, that's just another paragraph, you know, and I'll come back and then I know there'll be more. And that was the end, you know. It was almost like... It was getting to that end unaware and then kind of realizing you shouldn't say any more.
I've been speaking with Michael Andaja, author most recently of Divisadero, published by Knopf. Thank you, Michael, for joining me.
Thank you so much.
You can read an excerpt from Divisadero at kcrw.com/bookworm. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel, with assistance today from Alan Howard. The technical director is Mario Diaz, and our editor is, once again, Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones from our website. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm. Plus copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.